At this time, we begin the TechNet on line mark. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and along with K2 KEY, we try to answer people's questions about this fairly complicated hobby called ham radio. The person who signs into the TechNet does so by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. KS2XW, Russ, yes.
W2PNJ, Bob, no. Good evening, everyone.
KC2RXV, and my name is Ben. I have a question.
And WS2N, Paul, good evening. No questions, but I do have a space report.
KC2MDT, Steven, yes, I have a question tonight, Dick.
Students, have a nice Thanksgiving holiday, Dick.
Very fine, Aaron. Okay. At the end there, I heard both Aaron and Mel. At the beginning, we heard Ross with a yes, Bob with a no, Ben with a yes, Steve with a yes. And there were some doubles in there. Who did I miss?
N2MB with a no.
And WS2N Paul with a space report.
Yep, I should have said that. Okay, so Russ, Bob, Ben, Steve, Barry, Bill, and Paul. Am I missing anybody?
The name is Roy. I have no questions.
Okay, Roy, we missed your call letters, but we got your name. Russ, you're first. Hello, Foxtrot 2 X-ray Whiskey, I think it is. Go right ahead, Russ. My name is Dick.
Hey, good evening. Let's try to put this as simple as I can. I put up a loop antenna last weekend. It's about 300 feet of wire. It's a resident approximately at 3.7 megahertz. My question is, on the far end of the loop from the feed point, on the opposite end from the feed point, if I cut the wire and put an insulator in there, now it's not a loop, it's kind of like a square dipole. Will that change the characteristics of the antenna, the way it works, where it would be resonant?
Oh boy, you came to the right place. When it comes to great big loops on 80 meters, probably the expert on the East Coast is Mel K2KEY, and I'm going to pass it over to him in a minute. A little bit more than 300 feet in circumference, let's see now, 131 times 2 would be 260. Okay. I think a full wave loop on 80 meters, 75 meters, would be in the vicinity of 262 feet circumference. 300 feet is a little bit on the lengthy side, is my first impression. Second of all, whether the far end from where you feed it is open or short is going to make a huge difference on the input impedance, in my opinion. Mel's going to give you some more facts on that. Mel has full wavelength loop, which I'm guessing is around 265 feet circumference, 45 feet in the air. And he's done a lot of experimenting with feeding it differentially in parallel mode. Maybe he'll get a chance to explain that to you. And he's compared that full wave loop, 40 feet in the air, to a miniature loop that's in the shack with him. And the miniature loop works better, because he's got the freedom to orient it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. And the signal coming to you on 80 meters is going through that ionosphere. It's going through a number of Faraday rotations. Very frequently, the guy in London launches a signal to you that's vertically polarized, and it becomes horizontally polarized by the time you get it here in the States, or vice versa. So a polarization rotation is a much bigger factor than anyone's ever considered up till now. And as such, a small loop that's resonant, that's in the shack with you, in many, many circumstances, works better. It's, of course, the opposite of common sense. How in the world can this little loop in the shack with him have the same effective capture area as that great big chunk of wire 45 feet in the air? Mel's going to tell you a little bit more about that. K2KEY. Give Ross a full earful. K2RIW in the deck end.
Roger. Yeah, I guess I've had a bit of experience. This is K2KEY. All right, first of all, my loop is 272 feet and in square. And that's not a perfect square, but covers 272 feet. It's fed with open wire feed. Basically, my loop is one continuous number 12 wire. I just started at the shack, went up to the first to the insulator where the center would be or the connecting point would be, and then went around the fourth support, came back to that insulator, and then back down into the shack with the remainder wire, and used homemade poly plexiglass cases. Now it goes into, I feed it into a balanced feed into a Joe Johnson kilowatt matchbox. Straight through 600 ohm feed. And it's 45 feet, as Dick said, above the ground. My receiving loop is a little less than 0.1 wavelength in size. And like Dick says, I can orient it, and also many times through Faraday rotations, the signals are received 90 degrees, even though they've been transmitted horizontally. And in that case, when I can orient the receiving loop at a 90 degrees, and because of Faraday rotation and all, many times, like you said, the inside loop can do better, at least on receiving. I don't usually transmit on the inside loop, but let me let it drop. Okay, now, situation about leaving the loop open on one end, it no longer becomes what you went through all this work for to put up a loop. If you leave it open on that end, it changes the whole characteristic of the loop. Now, originally, I had tried something similar to that. I had the idea that you could, as Dick said, I was feeding it two different ways. I had two feed lines, and I was making it so I could parallel either way, switch phase and everything. I had all kinds of ideas, but it basically settled down to a fact that a closed loop seems to work better in comparison. I had a dipole, a full half-wave dipole, approximately around 130 feet of wire at 65 feet. But I found that for what I want to do on 75 meters, that's talk to my friends within a few hundred miles radius, up in Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, down Virginia, that yes, the loop has always been claimed as a bit of a cloud warmer NVIS type of antenna system, but for what I want to do with it, it is excellent. Let me let it drop again. Now, for 80 meters, it covers the 80 meter band real well. However, what I have, if you're interested now, depends on what you want to do on 80 meters. I like to also operate the low end of 80 meters, the CW portion of it, through low banding DX. For that, I have a vertical antenna that stands 65 feet, 66 feet high. That's a whole other situation with a lot, 100 radials put down. See, that's a different antenna. I find that for my situation, I really need two antennas. But if you're looking to do, like I say, just local, great local rag chewing, you know, within a few hundred miles on 75 meters, you've come to the right antenna as far as I'm concerned. Let me turn it back to Dick. This is KEY.
I'm going to plug in a couple more words before I send it back to you, Russ, and that is a full wave loop has an impedance that's a little bit on the high side, above 72 ohms, so to speak. But when you open circuit at the far end, you have a full half wave to the right, a full half wave to the left, and no connection between the two at the far end. That could easily give you a feed impedance of 1,000 ohms or so. So it's going to take an antenna tuner to make that resonate, in my opinion. But you're a guy who has done it. I haven't done it. I built lots of antennas on higher bands, and some of them are loop antennas, and it's given me some opinions on the subject. But as you can see, you're in a beautiful experimenter's paradise where you can start experimenting with feeding common mode or differential mode if you're using open wire feeder, like 450 or 600 ohm lateral line. and the right kind of an antenna tuner allows you to try quite a few different combinations, and Mel had quite a bit of fun with that, and it results at times that were difficult to understand, but a lot of fun to do. So we may have gotten a little bit too far off of your subject, but at least we're telling you a little bit about what we know and what we've seen so far, Russ. KF2, X-ray Whiskey, K2RIW.
Four thing, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
Now, about the feeder, I should have mentioned this about the feeder. A number of the loopers that are on 80 meters, 75 meters, gave me a suggestion that with a 600 ohm wire feeder, to drop it straight down about 36 feet it came to. I dropped the feeder down from the 45 to about 10 feet above ground. I didn't want it any closer than that because the open wire feeders and all that, because of any kind of hazard. And I found, you remember the problem I was having originally with the loop? Remember, I'd throw it slightly out of what you would think would be the dip point, the resonant point on the coupler, that would be where the signal would be received by the station maximum. Well, you remember, if I threw it from the dip back over one way or back through the dip in the other way, I got better signal report. This seems to have corrected itself by dropping the feed line, the 600 ohm feed line, directly vertically down. Before it was fed going out at an angle, actually it was going up and then slanting out at an angle over the roof. So I basically changed around. I originally, it was the way I was had the setup, but I turned the whole thing around. And that seems to have made a world of difference. Go ahead, Dick.
So, Russ, here's some of what we know. And back to you, sir. KF2XW, K2RIW.
K2EF.
Stand by, Richard. Go ahead, Russ.
KF2XW. Well, what I was originally trying to do was, I have a G5RV up, and I like to talk on 160, so I was trying to get as much wire up there as I could for 160, and I know it's not enough, and it's where we'll tune it. But I'm feeding it with ladder line, and I was just wondering if by making it like a square dipole, if that would be better or worse than what I have. That's really what I'm trying to figure out without actually climbing the tree and doing it. I just thought I'd get an opinion before I go through the trouble.
Okay. Is it going to be better or worse? That's sort of like, it almost, in my opinion, Ross, equivalent to asking the question, will I be happier if I marry a blonde or a brunette? In both cases, there's a lot more variables involved than first meets the eye. I will say that when you open the short circuit at the far end, the antenna will change, both in its polarization and the radiation characteristics, and where it puts the signal peak and valley, and how it resonates. If you're feeding it with open wire line, and at a frequency as low as 160 or 80 meters, the open wire line is so low in loss that the standing wave ratio on it almost doesn't matter. It doesn't give you any significant increase in insertion loss. As long as your antenna tuner has enough tuning range to handle all possible impedances, then if I were you, I would definitely go and open the far end, and I would go one step further. I'd make some kind of a remotely controlled relay by which I can open or close the far end and try the difference between the two. You'll have to change the impedance match each time you do that. And there's even a third thing you can do. You could put a 600 ohm resistor at the far end, and you now have a miniature version of a rhombic antenna. You're going to get three different antenna patterns, whether the far end is short, open, or terminated. And by listening or transmitting to people in those three different conditions, you can have a grand old time with this thing. I don't think Mel or I is going to be able to tell you which works better. I know it's going to be different, and so therefore, depending on the propagation of that particular day and that particular hour of the day, whether it be night or daytime, so to speak, high noon versus, well, let's face it, on 80 meters, the D-layer absorption is so bad, you make very few QSOs at high noon. But you know what I mean. Different times of the day, different portions of the sunspot cycle, it's going to be different, and I think it's a fun experiment. Let's see what Rich has got to say on this. N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, it's funny you bring this up. I was talking to Barry on the phone. I'm considering the same thing, but a vertical loop. I have a half-wave inverted V, and we were going to close it off making a triangle. It would be about 190 feet of wire and make the rest up with a stub for the relay at the far end so it could be open or closed. I wonder what experience you have with that arrangement now.
You did say Mel. By the way, when it comes to feeding that relay at the far end, by way of an RF choke, you could be feeding the B-plus through the ladder line, through the wire itself, to the relay at the far end. The relay is fed by an RF choke, so it doesn't affect the RF energy, whether the relay is closed or open. And then when the relay is closed, it closes a great big capacitor. You only have to have an RF short circuit at the far end. Whether or not you have a DC short circuit, radio-wise, doesn't matter. But by having a big capacitor that gets closed by the relay, you're now not shorting out the B-plus that you're feeding down the wire, and therefore you could be remotely controlling that relay. It wouldn't take a separate transmission line up to the relay, so to speak. I wonder if anyone on frequency has ever done an experiment like that. If so, give us your call letters right now. K2LIW listening.
I'll take, I did something similar, you know, I was using a, basically, what, the two feed lines into the shack, the two 600-ohm open wire feed lines, and if you remember, with the knife switch, I was able to make the arrangement that way, Dick.
Okay, that's another arrangement. When it comes to the short circuit at the far end, you can do that electronically by bringing down another piece of ladder line on the far end of where you open it up, Russ. You can bring that into the shack. You can feed it at the near end or the far end. That'll probably give you choosing patterns. And you can electronically tune that far end with a second antenna tuner or a poor man's equivalent of that, a variable capacitor, a variable inductor, or whatever. You will be electronically steering the beam of this thing. So you've got quite a toy there. I know we've launched into areas beyond what you were asking, but I think you're going to have a lot of fun with the experiment. And after you finish gathering the data and doing the experiment, I strongly recommend you write an article about what you've seen, how well it behaved, and how you did it. KF2XW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WJ2B with comment.
WJ2B, start off with your comment. Start off with your name first and then your comment, sir.
Yeah, how's it going, Dick? I just want to throw my two cents in there that I'm also a full-wave 80-meter loop person, and we have a triangular-shaped loop that's up about 30 to 35 feet, and about 120 feet on one side, and about 100 on the other, and about 80 on the other. So it's about a little less than 300 feet altogether, about 270, like you were saying. And I use it all over 80 meters, and I'm very, very happy with the performance. And I'm feeding it with regular RG8. I got about 35 feet of RG8. You know, the feed point is just almost directly overhead from my shack, and I run an amp through it with a kilowatt. No problems, no RF in the shack, no RF on the audio, anything like that. So works fine feeding it with coax. You know, if you can use it, I guess, on just 80. And I also use it on 160, fed the center. I disconnect the shield of the coax, feed the center conductor, and drive against station ground, and it works fine on 160 as a long wire also. So that could be you guys. Just wanted to throw my two cents at the loop. Is a great way to go, WJ2B.
Did you bother using any kind of a balancing device where the coax cable meets the wire of the loop? You don't have to, but it would be a little bit more balanced in this feed if you did. I wonder if you ever thought about that one, Kaz. Go ahead.
Yes, I did. I got 8 clamp-on toroids on there.
Okay, so you are using a real balancing-like structure. So maybe that gives you a few more ideas there, Russ. KF2XW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, looks like I'll be climbing a tree, huh? All right. Yeah, mine is fed with the ladder line and is a 4-to-1 balance built into the tuner, so that's the way I'm doing it. But okay, I knew there wouldn't be a simple answer, but I just wanted some opinions. Thank you very much. I'll be here listening. KF2XW.
And Russ, we strongly invite you back to tell us whatever you find, whether it be successful or non-successful, what you did, how it worked, whatever. Please come back and let us know. Okay, Bob said he didn't have a question, so we'll bypass him for now. You wait, Bob's going to change his mind. And Ben was next, KC2LXV, I think it is. You got it, Ben, K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick, and good evening, everybody else. It's Kilo Charlie 2 Romeo X-ray Victor. It's my accent, I know. Anyway, my question is very simple, I guess. I have two HTs, both of them fairly new, and both of them on paper with the same characteristics, 5 watts power on both bands, 2 meter and centimeter and 70 centimeter bands. One is an Kenwood HTF6 and one is a SOPX7. Using the same antenna from the same spot, exactly the same spot, and the same antenna, I mean not the same kind, but the same one physically, changing it from one HT to the other, one tend to outperform the other. How come?
When you say they outperform, one outperforms the other band, is that outperforming on transmission, outperforming on reception, or both? And when you say outperform, let's have a couple of more details here. If, for instance, you're trying to bring up a particular repeater with HT number one, and you can do it, and you flip over to HT number two, and it doesn't do it, and you have the right PL, that would be a difference in transmit performance. Or if you're listening to somebody else talking between the two handy-talkies, and one hears dead full quiet and the other one hears a pretty ratty signal, that would be a difference in receiver performance. So when you said difference in performance, you're going to have to give us a few more words there, Ben. KC2LXV, KC2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I'm sorry for my poor presentation of the question. You answered the question. That's exactly what happened. I'm sitting here on the same spot with the F6 and with the X7. And I can reach, for example, a repeater, no problem with the F6, but I cannot reach it with the VX7. And again, with the exact same antenna, physically the same one, and the same spot I'm sitting. And also receiving, I can hear the repeater very clear on the Kenwood, and I hear it scratchy, very scratchy, or not used at all on the VX7. Now, I thought maybe the VX7 is faulty. So a friend of mine just happened to purchase a brand new one. He came into my apartment with his, and I redid the experiment, and it was the same outcome. So I believe my VX7 is not faulty. Now, from again, I'm not an expert in electronics, neither play one in TV, but it seems to be the fundamentals of transmission and receiving are the same on every machine. So how come they don't perform the same?
Okay, I can think of about two or three reasons why you might see that difference. I also strongly recommend the next time Limark has a hamfest that you go there, stand in front of Andy, WA2CDL, WA2Charlie Delta Lima. He's the man who runs the tune-up clinic. He's a guy who works with radios day in and day out all of the days of his life. He owns an IFR. India Foxtrot Radio is the brand name of a service monitor. With that service monitor, he can measure the sensitivity of your two handy talkies. I mean, if each one of them gives you a quarter of a microvolt of sensitivity, that's a very good sign. If one of them gives you 5 microvolts of sensitivity, and the other one gives you half a microvolt, that's a huge difference. You would see that right away. So that's true sensitivity measured with laboratory test equipment. That's one thing you can do. The second thing Andy can do for you is he hooks up a cable to where your antenna normally goes, the rubber duck, and when you transmit into it, he looks at the power output of each of the two handy-talkies. He looks at the modulation, whether or not you've got the right level of PL tone, whether you've got the right level of audio, and whether you've got the right RF power output in the low and high power mode. So he can confirm that. Even if you pass that test, you're standing in front of Andy with the two handy talkies, and 10 minutes later, he gives you the report card on the two rigs, and they both get a clean bill of health. They both put out 5 watts, they both put out the right amount of PL tone, they both put out the same amount of power, they both have the right amount of deviation when you speak into the microphone and you say 5, 5, 5. It's one of the ways that people line up the deviation is they say the number 5. And you got that all set right. Even then, there could be a difference in performance if you happen to be located in a very heavy RF hot area. You take any two handy talkies, to the top of the Empire State Building, which has got a zillion transmitters running half a zillion watts, so to speak, and many of those handy-talkies, because there's so much strong local RF, will become overloaded. They'll almost jump out of your hand, and they give all kinds of crazy responses. So if you happen to live next door to a paging transmitter, and you're getting strong signal overload, that could be a difference. I don't think that. That's a long shot. So when in doubt, you've done the first step by having somebody come over your house with the exact same model of radio and got the same performance. That's a good step. However, you'd like to know what's going on. Even though both of those VX7s behave the same, that doesn't mean that they're both perfect. There could be something wrong with that particular production run, where that whole production run runs 10 microvolts of sensitivity instead of half a microvolt of sensitivity. So when in doubt, it's time to make measurements, Ben, as I see it. And I think you want to schedule a tune-up clinic or a thorough, let's see now, what do they call it, a thorough overhaul? No, when you go to the doctor once every year and he does a full set of tests, whatever that is, you want to do that to your handy-talkie to find out what's going on. But you do have a bit of a mystery there. And when you find out, I sure hope you'll come back and tell us all what you found. KC2LXB, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I think I can give him the answer, Dick.
Oh-ho, go right ahead then, Mel. He's sitting there on the edge of his chair.
Okay, back in the net mode here. All right. I had a similar experience with somebody, and what they were doing show you that how strange some of these handy talkies are because of the design, that they were trying to use a rubber ducky. Just to give you the example, they had 2 5-watt radios, and one was an ICOM, and the other one was a Yaesu. Same connector on the top of the NC connector. And yet they said, what happened, why is the ICOM, this rubber ducky, will hit a lot of repeaters and everything, and why if I put it on the ASU, 5 watts and all, why don't I get the same result on the ASU with the same rubber ducky? And the point is, you can't interchange antennas on a lot of these radios. You've got to use the antenna that the radio comes with. In other words, they supply you that rubber ducky, that's the one you got to use. You can't just go from one to the other. Dick, it's the design of the transmitter. Well, it's more than design, because I see the same problem with the receiver. There's something in the design of the network that's in there. The most likely part of the filter network, I would assume that's on the tail end of the, just before the antenna deck, over.
Yeah, QGZ recognized, and I'll turn it over to Bill in a second. You hit a very good point there. Whenever you go to a flea market, Ben, and you walk up to a guy that's selling rubber duck antennas, and you say, hey, I want to buy a rubber duck antenna for my handy-talkie, he'll ask you what brand name of handy-talkie and what model number. Each brand of handy-talkies has their own way of impedance matching to their particular rubber duck. The way the rubber duck or any other similar antenna behaves is that the antenna system must hit resonance. The antenna system consists of the rubber duck, the feed line going to it, the impedance matching network between it and the transmitter, and the final stage of the transmitter. That whole combination has to hit resonance, and each manufacturer has his own favorite way of doing it. They're all a little bit different. So if you take rubber duck from model number A and put it in on model B, it might not behave as it should. Let's see what Bill's got to say. Mr. QGZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Negative. I kind of follow up with from Mel a little bit. Specifically with the VX7, that radio, really they're trying to take that little rubber whippy dippy and do four bands with it to transmit 140. 220, 440, and 52 megahertz. And in poking around trying a number of different aftermarket antennas, I mean, I'm looking at three or four laying in a drawer right here, I found that nothing but the OEM antenna actually radiates well and works the best. I mean, I can use
a shortened VHF, UHF helical style antenna. And it works, but it works. In other words, I can use it around the house through the, like the pack repeater, crossband pack repeater on my truck. But for actual performance, even to relatively strong local VHF repeaters, it's pretty mediocre. And the only thing that really seems to radiate properly is that the OEM antenna. I can tell you also the same thing with the FT-60, another Yaesu radio. That one's simply VHF, UHF, and that one, almost every other non-OEM antenna seem to have reduced performance on one band or the other. So especially with the VX7, where you're trying to balance out four bands into that one antenna, they may be doing some stuff in there that doesn't lend itself to non-OEM antenna. The radio antenna is not designed for that radio.
WQTJ. Okay, we didn't copy that call letters. You were over-modulating. And by the way, we may be accusing Ben of unplugging the right antenna and plugging in the wrong one. And maybe he didn't do that. The new station you just signed in, talk a little softer and try again.
Hi, Dick. Pete Spry, W2 Tango, Tango, Tango. It's Gordon here. And I've had a VX7R for the longest time. It was an unfortunate departure from my hip on a hiking trail. But I used an aftermarket antenna on it, and I can't speak to its 6-meter performance, although it didn't seem to be that much different, terribly out of 6 meters. But the from a transmitter viewpoint on 2, 222, and 440, I did much better with any number of several diamond antennas. I can't tell you the model number, but I had some multi-band diamond antennas that seemed to work much better than the OEM antenna did.
Okay, very interesting to know. Gordon, by the way, Whiskey 2 Triple Tango, is the main person that I know about that leads the technical net in New Jersey of the BARA organization, Bergen County Amateur Radio, I guess it's an association. They have a tech net on Thursday night, which I believe starts at 7:30. And they're also listed on the same website as this particular tech net. When you go to amateurradio.tv, you'll see the listings for both tech nets with the playback audio on both. So, alrighty, Gordon's got a good suggestion there, Gordon, that there are aftermarket other brands that you like. But to start off with, you probably ought to use the one that's supplied. I'll bet you Ben did that. I think we're probably falsely accusing Ben of unplugging the antenna that came with the VX7. I bet you he's using that one. But Gordon, we're going to give it back to you. KC2LXV, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Did you really mean it to me or LXV?
I'm trying to send it back to Ben, LXV, right now. And then we'll pick up everybody else. Go ahead, Ben.
Okay, what I did, I didn't use the rubber duck. I used a Diamond SRH320, which is a tri-band aftermarket antenna, which can very recommended by everybody. And now I got confused, because the other gentleman says that we should use the rubber duck. That would be the best. Everybody told me to get the SRH320, the Diamond. So I'm a little bit confused now altogether. But that's what I did. I got rid of the rubber ducks, first of all, when I got both of them, and I installed the SRH320. Back to you, Dick, and thank you very much, by the way.
Ditto on my THF6, W2TG.
There's more to the story here. Thank you, Gordon, but there's more to the story here, Ben. When you're using a rubber duck, because you're running portable, the one that's supplied is probably the best. Whenever you use any other kind of antenna on the connector that normally goes to the rubber duck, and if that other antenna is on the roof of your house or in any kind of a higher location, unless you've really chosen a bad antenna, as long as it's one that's tuned to those particular frequencies, it should work better. On VHF, UHF frequencies, altitude counts an awful lot. So any brand of antenna that gives you up extra altitude is most likely going to behave better. And if you're using one that's really rated for all of the frequencies of interest, it's going to work even better yet. So should you use a rubber duck or should you use a aftermarket antenna that's on top of the roof? The answer is yes to both questions, depending on what you're doing. If you're portable, use the rubber duck they supply. is my suggestion. But if by any means you can get an antenna that's higher in altitude, that by a transmission line you connect to that radio, most of the time I think that's going to work better. I'm going to pass it over to Gordon for some further words on this. W2, Tango, 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 K2RIW.
Okay, I'm going to be at home by the time we get too far along. I won't be able to listen to the responses, but not coming back again. But, the SRH-320 from Diamond is very good on most of these radios. I actually did use one on 2 meters on my VX7. It worked in a much superior manner, but there was some other Diamond antenna that I used that I felt even worked better yet. Further, on the THF-6, the factory antenna is miserable. So you will have profoundly better performance with virtually everything, including a loaded 19-inch whip.
Gordon, you're a busy guy. He's driving the car. He's got his cell phone ringing. He's talking on the ham radio. The children are playing games, and they probably want to talk to him, too. Okay, what a busy fella. Alrighty, I wonder if some of that made some sense to you, Ben. And if not, you're allowed to ask us more questions. KX2LXV, K2RIW.
WJ2B with a comment.
J2B, stand by for a second, Kaz. Go ahead, Ben.
Okay, basically, again, I'm confused altogether. I really tried to use, which I never tried to use, the original Apple Tax. That's something I didn't do. The first thing I did when I got the HT that replaced the antenna. It's like we do on motorcycles. The first thing you do, you replace the exhaust. So I don't know. I should try with the original Apple Tax on each one of them. And the second step will be to, I guess, talk to Andy. That would be a good idea. And again, thank you very much to everybody who helped me over this issue.
Okay, when you finish making those other experiments with your snow rubber duck and any other antenna you try, find back and let us know. Kaz, you're next. WJ2B, what would you like to add?
Okay, Dick, you got my first name. I was Joe, Juliet, Oscar, Echo, and I just wanted to ask the guy talking about the rubber ducks that what people have told me, certain rubber ducks are different impedance matching than others. So you have to make sure that if you're going to use a factory rubber duck that you have the right model rubber duck. It's not just an ICOM. There are little numbers usually ingrained in the plastic at the base of the rubber duck. Make sure you have the right model on the right radio because the matching networks are slightly different in the different radios to match to the different rubber ducks depending on how many bands they're covering. One rubber duck I can recommend is the Diamond RH-77. That's a 2-meter 440 N wideband receive. It's a little longer than your standard, about a foot long, a little bit bigger than your standard rubber duck, but it's tremendous on 440. It gives you much better performance than a typical rubber duck. And most of the aftermarket antennas will give you improved performance, being that they're usually longer than the stock rubber duck. But you have to make sure you match the right rubber duck to the right radio. You might see a poor performance if you have the wrong matching scheme going on with the wrong antenna on the wrong radio. I also have a 10 gigahertz scenario for you on a little item that I picked up in the store that would pick whatever you want to change the subject. So WJ2B,
comment, please.
Okay, Joe, you're on the list right after Steve, and we'll come back to your 10 gig question. Steve, KG2NDP is going to be next, and then we're at the end of our list of questions. We'll pick up yours before picking up the face report. The person with comment, please give us your full call letters, your name, and then your comment. Go right ahead, sir. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, good evening. WW2WW, my name is Tim, Central New Jersey. Just was enjoying listening to the gentleman about the Yaesu's, two of my favorite radios. Honestly, I like both of them, but the VX6 is probably going to get my vote because of a couple of more things, and I like the free frequency counter, and it's kind of a nice feature. The only thing it's really missing is the ability to mix between the two and the 440 and listen to both band, main band, and sub band. The other thing that he doesn't fall into, which I wanted to make a comment in, is when the gentleman was talking about the performance difference, you have to be careful on your miscellaneous setting on the functions. Miscellaneous setting number 18 that your attenuator is not on, you can attenuate your signal, so make it sound like you're not hearing the same thing. and it is absolutely true. I had a great antenna, a 2 meter 440 dual band on my VX6 that worked marvelous. It even worked pretty good on 220. But as soon as I put it on the VX7, I tell you, it lost 80% or better of its functionality and its transmit and receive capability, which is absolutely amazing. So you have to be very careful what type of aftermarket or other OEM type of product that you put on the antenna on the VX7. It's very touchy. The VX6 is much more forgiving, has a louder receive, and it allows you to play around with a couple of different antennas. So the VX7 is a very touchy radio when it comes to using other kinds of antennas. It absolutely amazed me. I was like, what in the world happened to my radio? But nothing happened to the radio when I went back to the Rubber Duck OEM antenna. It worked perfectly. So that's just 2 points that I had about that. Them radios, they are my favorites. WW2WW.
Very fine, Tim. Thank you for all that information. Amazing about that sensitivity. Also, I can see in the case of a handy talkie, depending on how severe is the environment you're in, if there is a built-in 10 or 20 dB resistive attenuator that can be dialed in, if, for instance, you were standing on top of the Empire State Building observation deck and you got all these zillions of transmitters nearby, boy, it would really make the performance improvement tremendous if you plugged in the attenuation. And, of course, that sounds crazy. I personally have experienced that during contests where I had a step attenuator between my 432 meg antenna and my receiver system in the shack. And because I've got line of sight across the Long Island Sound to the guys in Connecticut, and occasionally you get a real good contest operation in Connecticut where they've got a whole lot of real potent transmitters in direct line of sight of me, and they're overloading the front end like crazy, and I want to listen to a weak signal. There are times when the weak signal is being covered up by the intermod of a properly operating, very strong station at 20 kc up the dial, and you plug in a 10 or a 20 decibel attenuator, and you stop what looks like splatter, but it's really overloaded your receiver. And there are times when the weak signal you want to listen to, under contest conditions, the weak signal gets stronger when you plug in a 10 or a 20 dB attenuator. I've done it during contests, and it works, and I know it sounds crazy, but I can explain some of the theory of third-order intermodulation distortion that explains where it's coming from. And what's really, I'll give you one or two bottom lines that you won't understand right away. Tuck it into the back of your brain, and someday it'll come forward, so to speak. And that is, when you're getting a intermodulation distortion product into your receiver because of two other signals up the dial that are very strong, and you plug in 10 decibels of RF attenuation between your rig and the antenna, the third order intermodulation distortion will decrease by 30. Let me repeat that. 10 dB of attenuation will make the intermodulation distortion product go down by 30 decibels. That's if it's a third order. If it's a fifth order, it'll go down by 50 decibels, 3-to-1 or 5-to-1. And so you can see under weak conditions, if that intermod happens to fall on top of the weak signal you want to listen to, the 10 dB of attenuation is attenuating your weak signal by 10, but attenuating the intermod that's covering up by 30, you come out 20 dB ahead by plugging in a 10 dB step attenuator. The mathematics of that can be confirmed. The common sense about it, of course, it sounds crazy. Try it, you'll like it. So if somebody has built a handy talkie with a built-in attenuator that can be dialed in, at times that's handy. But if the radio doesn't automatically always wake up with the attenuator out, if the last time you use the radio, somehow you hit the wrong key, the attenuator got turned on, and if the attenuator stays on forever, that could give you a significant amount of pilot error. That would be something worth correcting downrange. So maybe that happens some of the time. Anybody with comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. How about that? I expect you guys have a lot of comments on that one. Okay. The next person on the list was Steve, Kilo Golf 2, Mike Delta Papa. Steve, you're on the runway, K2LIW. Take off, sir.
Good evening to you, Dick. Good evening to everyone on the net. I'd like to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving coming up. Dick, I'm looking to put together, let's say, 902 megahertz repeater. And
No, it's going to be nothing major, 30 watts maximum output. Now, imagine I'm going to need a 200 cavity filter. And I was curious, you know, I was going to look on eBay and see if I can scrounge something up. Is there anything I should look for, anything I should stay away from? And is it possible, being that the advanced with 25 meg apart, can I use two antennas, transmit antenna, receive antenna? If this is possible, how far would I have to keep them away from each other? Back to you.
Okay, the so-called 902 band, which is one of the license-free bands that we amateurs share, covers 902 to 928 megacycles, so it is 26 megacycles wide, end-to-end. We amateurs tend to operate 1 meg from the end, therefore we have 24 or 25 megs of it that we think we can use, but there's really 26 megs there. So 26 megs of separation on a good, well-designed duplexing filter, that should work like a charm. That's a lot of frequency space. Now, your implied question is, what brand name, what model number of duplexing filter is a good one? And there I don't know. Sinclair, among other companies, and Cellwave, I think they both make some very fine duplexing filters. Unfortunately, their prices might be a little bit steep for you. By way of eBay, you probably can buy something a hell of a lot cheaper. There are times when the 902 meg region, like the paging transmitters that used to exist at 930 meg, quite a bit of that hardware a few years ago started hitting the surplus market, the eBay market. There used to be a communication service at around 890 megacycles that was very popular in the central United States, around the Texas area. And recently I've gotten my hands on some of that equipment by talking to my buddies who live in Texas. And boy, that was very well-designed equipment. Also, if you decide to later on go to higher power, the so-called ELPA, E-L-P-A amplifier series is a 600-watt, a 300-watt, and a 150-watt series of amplifiers that were originally designed for cell phone service at, let's say, 890 megs, and a very minor amount of conversion required to move them up to the 902 band. They run on 28 volts, and boy, can those things put out the very, very well-designed amplifiers. They originally cost around $10,000 per amplifier. You look inside and you'll say, it's worth it, and they're being sold on eBay for numbers like $150 for a 600-watt amplifier. And that thing has got hair on its chest. That is a sturdy amplifier. Very good design. And because Motorola decided to upgrade to a slightly different design, they're scrapping out equipment and in some cases has never been out of the box. And many of these have got date codes of 1998-type numbers, which by my standards is modern equipment when it's that well-designed. So there is equipment available. I think you're going to find it difficult to go out and find a handy talkie that's ready to roll on 902 meg or 903 meg ham band. An awful lot of guys start off with some commercial equipment that they make modifications to, reprogram it, and get it to operate down into the ham band. So I think there are very few handy talkies, but you're going to want a handy talkie eventually, and you're going to want mobile rigs. So with some digging, there's some equipment there. Now, a couple of words. Let me drop for a second. I expected to hear a beep, and thank goodness there isn't one. When it comes to duplexing filters, a really good duplexing filter, state-of-the-art, would have three cavities on the transmit frequency, three cavities on the receive frequency. Both of those six cavities all come together on one simple output connector that goes to the antenna. And if those cavities are really working well, you'll have 1.5 dB of insertion loss through the transmitting cavities on the transmit frequency, and the same thing for the receive frequency on the receive cavities. And the transmit frequency will be rejected by the receive cavity by something like 120 decibels or more, if it's a really good design. So the number of decibels of rejection of the transmit signal through the common port going to the antenna, back into the receiver filter, back into your receiver. That's the main thing the duplexing filter has to do for you. You want a fraction of a milliwatt maximum, a very small fraction of a milliwatt maximum, to ever get into the receiver from the transmit frequency. That's what the duplexing filter has got to supply for you. If not, your receiver will be overloaded, you'll get intermodulation distortion, you'll get spurious responses, you'll get desensitization when the transmitter's on the air, and you'll be somewhat unhappy. A split site, where you're using two separate antennas, one for transmitting and one for receiving, helps a lot, but you still need a set of cavity filters, unless you're able to operate the two things 3 miles apart, which is very unlikely. And even if you had the real estate to do that, I wouldn't recommend it, because you'd have one set of coverage for the transmit, another set of geography that's the coverage for receive, and they wouldn't come together quite right. You certainly want the transmit antenna and the receive antenna at the same site, close to the same altitude, which means they're going to be coupling very strong signals between the two, and you still need quite a bit of filtering. So if you go split antennas, it eases the filtering. But if you decide to use one single antenna and make it one very good antenna, in my opinion, it's the better approach. That's the good news. But the bad news, it places a more stringent requirement on the quality of the duplexing filter assembly. So I haven't told you brand name, but I told you a little bit about what I think you're looking for there, as I see it, Steve. And I'll bet you there are people on frequency who have got some experience at 902 setting up repeaters, and maybe they can help. If there is such a person out there, please give us your call letters right now and your name, KQLIW in the TechNet. Okay, I heard KE2EJ. Eric, your audio is 20 decibels low. I'm wearing earphones and I heard it. So you better start eating that microphone. Go right ahead, Eric.
Hi. You can hear me better now.
Fantastic. Were you talking into the back of the mic, or were you just being real quiet tonight?
No, we're begging tonight. This weather is quite nice. One thing I highly recommend to the gentleman is going to attempt to put something on 902, and you're going to find out it's not a very happy band to work in. Get coordinated so you can get a frequency. There are quite a number of repeaters around, and there's a lot of non-licensed stuff around, and there's some commercial stuff right smack in the middle of the band, so it can be a lot of fun.
Okay, so you strongly recommend you go to it used to be called TSOC, Tri-State Amateur Repeater Coordination. What is the coordinating committee called these days? I'm a little in the dark here, Eric. Go ahead.
Metro Core is what it's called. They have a website. And the Metropolitan Repeater, I don't remember what the acronym stands for. You can Google Metro Core and you'll find it.
Probably Metropolitan Coordinating Committee or something like that. Okay, so the good news as I see it, Steve, is that 902 ham radio-wise is very lightly used. Yes, there are a number of license-free items being used there, but by the way of the FCC's rules, all those license-free things have to be frequency hopping continuously. There's like 51 channels spread across 902 to 928. They're not allowed to dwell more than a few milliseconds on each one of those channels. So they're continuously hopping in a random frequency select technique. So therefore, even if you're getting QR Mary from some other local service, they tend to be intermittent in characteristic, and because of the frequency hopping, most likely everybody can play nice and coexist on that band. So it's kind of a wide open territory, not very much ham radio use has been made of it. So I think you can have quite a bit of fun with it. KG2MDT, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. You gave me a wealth of information as usual. At least I have now an idea of what I got to look for and what I got to do. Once again, I thank you. I thank the other gentlemen for the information. I will look up MetroCore and drop them an email and see what information they give me so I can get this thing rolling. Once again, thanks, Dick. Back to you.
W2PNJ.
I knew he'd eventually come in here. Go right ahead, Bob.
I'm trying to locate a brand of a small video monitor. Something that I could plug into my ICOM unit. Something mobile, something small. Anybody idea with a brand name or anyone on frequency can help?
Now, you say video monitor, and this is to monitor what now, Bob? In other words, in the receive mode, you would like something like a pan adapter. Not quite sure what you're asking for yet. You got it, Bob.
You got an IC7000?
Say that a little bit slower and a little bit louder. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, he's probably got an IC7000. Gets the video out from the radio. There are quite a few displays out there, and they run the range of price. You get them as cheap as $100. And you get them $300-$400, depending on what size you want. And what you want to do is you want to go to your local hi-fi store, believe it or not, and they sell these monitors for cars. There are other ways you can find them cheaper and more expensive, but that's a good place to start. If you want to go towards the professional stuff, which is a little more expensive, you can hit P&A photo. But there's quite a few of them out there these days.
Rich recognized that. Eric, before we leave you, do you have a recommended brand name if you were buying the video monitor for Ben's radio? What would be your favorite brand name that gives a that gives pretty good response, but doesn't cost $1 zillion? You got it, Eric.
Okay. Well, I'm biased towards the broadcast stuff. It costs $1 zillion. But there's things like AudioVox and Pioneer and all the big brand names. Most of the displays are made by the same group of manufacturers. So, you know, you're buying a name more than anything else.
Okay. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your comments.
Okay, Dick. I have a 7000 in my car, and I installed a flat panel display on the sun visor. So when the sun visor is down, you can hook up, sort of scan your eyes up, and see the display from the 7000. I can't give them a brand name because we're going to put it by a place here in Bayside. It's in my mobile installation called ABC Lock and Glass. And he cut out the visor, he mounted it, he hooked it up to the power and everything. The whole thing ran me crazy.
Okay, interesting. So maybe those are somewhat helpful to you, Bob. W2PNJ, KQRIW.
Okay, fine business. Thank you so much for the lead.
Okay, come back with some more questions if you want some more details on that. Okay, Joe, I don't know how I heard your name as Kaz. I heard you say something that sounded like that. I thought you were giving me your name. So, Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo, go ahead and tell us about 10 Gig, one of my favorite bands. You got it, Joe.
Okay, Dick, no problem, WJ2B. Yeah, I was just going to say to PNJ, what N2EL mentioned is a very good idea. If he's looking for a small LCD video in-type monitor, you should try a car stereo installation store or possibly a Circuit City or Best Buy. They sell those little monitors that go for people that want to put a DVD player for their kids in the back seat, and they usually install them in the headrests of the front seat. One of those little monitors would probably do what you want to do there. And, okay, as far as 10 gigs go, Dick, I found out through some searches on the Internet about DRO oscillators that there is a, believe it or not, a full X-band that operates on 10.525 gigahertz with a DRO oscillator receiver. Microprocessor, it's a full X-band radar setup for less than $30 that you can buy in Toys R Us. It's made by Hot Wheels for measuring the speed of Hot Wheels little cars, you know, that go around the track, and it'll give you the miles per hour or kilometers per hour, and it might make a good 10 gigahertz HT if you can modify it. There's a couple of articles on the Internet already about people that took them apart to see how they managed to do it for less than $30. So that might be an interesting project for the tech men, is to build a couple of 10 gigahertz HTs with a couple of these Hot Wheels radar guns there. That could be the WJTV.
Yeah, I see some both good and bad about that one, Joe. Hot Wheels radar gun. Dielectric resonator oscillator, DRO, that's one of these, barium tetratitanate, that's the name of the stuff, and acted like the crystal and persisted on the right frequency. That's the good news. And the price is right. And it probably has pretty good sensitivity and a reasonable amount of transmitter power output. But it is a free-running system. And now we're into that discussion of what's called wideband versus narrowband.